The Afternoon Play. We come now to the second play based on Robert Graves' novels I, Claudius and Claudius the God, which we are broadcasting as part of our 90th birthday tribute to that poet and novelist.
Claudius! 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 Claudius!
Claudius the God by Robert Graves. In a radio version by Eric Ewens, adapted by Glyn Dearman. With Timothy West as Claudius, Mel Martin as Messalina, Francis Peter as Calpurnia, Harold Casket as Herod, Henry Stamper as Caractacus, Brett Usher as Xenophon, and Narissa Knight as Agrippina. Claudius the God.
I have told you of how I, Claudius, the cripple, the stammerer, the fool of the family, whom none of his ambitious and bloody-minded relatives considered worth the trouble of executing, poisoning, forcing to suicide, banishing to a desert island, or starving to death, of how I survived them all, even my insane nephew Caligula, and was one day unexpectedly acclaimed emperor by the corporals and sergeants of the palace guard. You may recall that both my grandfather and my father were convinced republicans, and that I took after them. The reigns of my uncle Tiberius and my nephew Caligula merely confirming my anti-monarchical prejudices. I was 50 years old when I was acclaimed emperor, and at that age one does not lightly change one's political color. You will realize how strong was the immediate necessity for yielding to the caprice of the soldiers. To have refused would have meant not only my own death, but that of my wife, Messalina, with whom I was deeply in love, and of our unborn child. I wonder why it is that one feels so strongly about an unborn child. Herod Agrippa, the Jewish king, happened to be on a visit to Rome, and he played a considerable part in the day's events. He and I were exact contemporaries, and had been brought up together at the court of Augustus. Herod was Rome's best ally in the Near East. As I was being carried round the great court of the palace on the shoulders of two corporals, I saw a glint of color at the back of the crowd.
Set me down, please.
Claudius!
You stay where you are, sir. Hold on.
Please, I think I see King Herod the Gripper, but please let me down.
King, eh?
We'll set you down if you promise not to run away.
Perfectly well, I can't run. Set me down.
Here you are, sir.
Thank you. Ask King Herod to come over here, please.
I'll get him for you. You stay there.
Thank you. And then I dine with you all at your camp. Much as my life is worth to insult this devoted soldier.
Congratulations, Caesar, on your election. May you long enjoy the great honors that these brave soldiers have bestowed on you, and may I have the glory of being your first ally.
Your old friend, my beautiful Marmoset.
Herod, I have never cared for your nickname for me.
You call me the brigand. Is that any better? Let us not argue. I know what you are feeling. I know that you don't really want to be emperor, that you're a republican at heart.
I'm not emperor yet. The Senate has yet to meet.
You have some stupid idea of yielding up your power to the Senate as soon as the soldiers let you go.
I will not deny it.
That would be madness. If you do what you are thinking, it will be the signal for civil war.
The Senate are a flock of sheep,
but there are three or four wolves among them who will be ready the moment you lay down your power to fight for it among themselves.
Who, for instance?
There's Asiaticus, for a start. Not to mention Venetianus. They were both in a conspiracy against Caligula, so they are likely to do something desperate for fear of being executed. And if it's not them, it'll be somebody else.
And why shouldn't it be?
Because you are the only obvious emperor for Rome, and you'll have the army behind you. If you won't take on the responsibility because of some absurd prejudice, it'll be the ruin of everything. Caligula's murder was not unexpected.
I agree. The mystery is that it was so long in coming.
Well, then, since my arrival in Rome, my interest has been solicited from various directions.
Not by me.
Agreed. Not by you, but by others.
And how did you respond?
I made one point and one point only, to which in turn I said, have you the army behind you?
But yes, have you no principles, but political ones, I mean?
I will speak frankly. The Republican form of government appears to me in certain circumstances a most estimable thing. I would say the same of a benign monarchy. No one can make a hard and fast rule that one form of government is essentially better than another. Only one general rule can be made.
Which is?
No sensible man would give a snap of his fingers for any government, whether democratic, plutocratic, aristocratic, or autocratic, that cannot count on the support of the armed forces of the state over which it pretends to rule. Only you can do that at the moment, Claudius. Your duty is clear.
But, Brigand, you are a man of ideas. If I accept, will you stay in Rome and help me?
Oh, I cannot stay, little marmoset. I have a kingdom to govern. My duty is to my own country, not to Rome.
It's strange. I always expected you to be a king, but if anyone had ever told me I'd be your emperor, I'd have called him a madman.
You're a fool, as I've always told you, but you have a fool's luck. You'll be an Olympian god. When I'm only a dead hero.
Nonsense, Claudius the god.
Don't laugh. Marmoset, would you have a little more of my excellent advice?
Please, dear Vicar.
My advice to you is this. Never trust anyone.
What?
Never trust your most intimate friend, your dearest child, the wife of your bosom, or the ally joined to you by the most sacred oath. Trust yourself only.
Why do you say that? Against whom are you putting me on my guard?
Everyone, little marmoset. So, will you rule? Make history instead of writing it?
You cannot fight against fate. I must do my best.
Excellent. Come, let us join your loyal soldiery.
Romans! You could not have made a wiser choice. I congratulate you. When you arrive, courageous, generous, learned, and just, you can trust him as completely as you trusted his glorious brother, Germanicus. Don't be fooled by the Senate or any of your senior officers. Stick by the Emperor Claudius and he'll stick by you. I have just been advising him to pay you well for your loyalty. Hey, Caesar.
What? Here is what I have decided. To each captain, a bounty of 500 gold pieces. To each guardsman, 150 gold pieces. There were so many things to be done in the process of clearing up the mess that Caligula had left behind him, nearly 4 years of misrule, that it makes my head swim even now to think of it, after 13 years as emperor. For, of course, I was unable to do what I had intended, namely to resign the monarchy as soon as the excitement aroused by Caligula's assassination had died down. The mess was such a complete mess that I knew of nobody in Rome beside myself who would have the patience to undertake the hard and thankless work that the cleaning up process demanded. The best choice of many evils was to remain in power myself, for a time at least. hoping to be relieved as soon as possible and being as un-emperor-like as I could in the meantime. I appointed a series of ministers to help me. I confirmed Callistus, who had been public treasurer under Caligula, in his post. I encouraged him by saying I thought he had done remarkably well in keeping Caligula supplied with money for so long, and that I counted on him henceforth to use his gold divining powers for the salvation of Rome. Pallas I put in charge of my privy purse. Narcissus I made chief secretary for home affairs and private correspondence. Polybius was my religious secretary, for I was high pontiff as well as emperor, and he was to assist me in my historical work, if ever I should get the time for it. I made the senator Vitellius my understudy, in case I should happen to fall ill, or anything worse should happen to me. My beloved Messalina helped me with these ministerial appointments. You know, my dear, the sharp edge of my republican fervor is already becoming a little blunted.
Oh?
Every day I feel more and more sympathy for Augustus and respect for my grandmother Livia, too, in spite of my personal dislike of her. She must have had a wonderfully methodical mind. If I could get the governmental system working again even half as well as it worked under her, I would be most satisfied with myself.
If you undertake the role of Augustus, my dearest, perhaps I could play the part of Livia for you.
Oh, don't even suggest such an idea.
I was only joking, of course. But seriously, Claudius, I do have something of Livia's gift for summing up people's characters and deciding just what appointments they're fit to hold. If you were to give me a free hand, I could act on your behalf on all social questions. I could relieve you of all the cares connected with the office of public morals.
I love you, my dearest Messalina, and in helping me choose my ministers, I have found your judgment very shrewd. But to take on the sort of responsibility you are suggesting...
Well, let me prove to you my capability for such a post.
How?
Let me go through the nominal role of the Senate. I will tell you the names I think are fit to remain on it, and those that are not. Judge me on that.
I called for the roll, and we began to go through the list. I must confess I was so astonished at her detailed knowledge of the capacities and characters and the private and public histories of the first 20 or so names on it, that I readily granted her request, and she took over most of my duties as my director of public morals. The most important task that now presented itself was the reorganization of state finances. Caligula, you will recall, had drained both the treasury and privy purse dry. I held a conference with Callistus, my public treasurer, and Pallas, my keeper of the privy purse. Gentlemen, the first problem that we face is how to get hold of ready money for immediate expenses.
If I may make a suggestion, Caesar.
Yes, Callistus.
A good deal of Caligula's wasteful expenditure was on gold and silver ornaments and objects here in the palace. But they could be removed and converted into gold coins.
Yes.
And even the gold doorknobs and the window frames could be replaced.
An excellent idea. Have them melted down.
There is also the gold and silver furniture in his temple, Caesar, and his great gold statue. Oh. That alone melted down would make a million gold pieces.
Then have it melted down, Pallas. We need to put more coinage into circulation.
And we could add to that money by borrowing in the name of Jove from the temples to the other gods, whose treasuries have become cluttered over the years by useless and showy offerings.
Oh?
And I know for a fact that the temple of Apollo has 200 or 300 silver tripods. I'm sure if his father Jove was in need, Apollo would be only too pleased to lend him a few.
A loan to Jove being the same as a loan to the treasury. The most important thing is to restore public confidence and so force back into circulation the money that has been hoarded by nervous businessmen. So although great economy is necessary, it must not be interpreted as meanness.
Agreed.
I annulled many of Caligula's barbarous edicts, releasing from prison hundreds of citizens of all degrees that he had caused to be placed there. I also remembered my promise to Livia to have her made a goddess, and addressed the Senate on the subject.
My lord,
It is not for... It is not for me to decide whether my grandmother is worthy of national deification by your votes or whether she is not. I can only repeat that I swore to her that if ever I became emperor, an event which I admit seemed both improbable and absurd at the time, although she prophesied it was to be... a divine vision, perhaps. I promised her I would do my best to persuade you to raise her to heaven, where she might stand once more at the side of her faithful husband, Augustus. I should warn you that if you refuse my request today, I shall renew it every year at the same season until you grant it. And so long as my life is spared, and I am still privileged to address you from this chair.
We deified Livia without delay, and voted her a statue to be placed alongside that of Augustus in his temple. Also, I should tell you that I bought Calpurnia. You remember the pretty young prostitute who had lived with me before I married Messalina? I bought her a charming villa near Ostia and gave her a comfortable income. But I never visited her there for fear of making Messalina jealous. When Messalina gave birth to my son, Drusus, whom I later called Britannicus, I experienced all the pride of parenthood for the first time. For my son, Drusillus, who had been murdered some 20 years before, I had felt no warm parental feelings, and very few for my daughter, Antonia. This was because my marriages with Ergolanilla, Drusillus's mother, and with Elia, Antonia's mother, had been forced on me, whereas I was passionately in love with Messalina. I soon found myself popular with the people. Money began coming in, and I was able to abolish more taxes. My ministers were running their departments to my satisfaction. However, the facilities for unloading corn at the port of Ostia I found most inadequate. Indeed, the whole question of corn supply was a very difficult one. Caligula had left the public granaries as empty as the public treasury. I determined to solve this matter once and for all by making Ostia a safe port even in the worst weather, and sent for engineers to survey the place and draw up a scheme.
We have done as you told us, Caesar, but of course the cost will be prohibitive.
I employed you as an engineer, not as my financial advisor. That role is carried out by Callistus here.
But I agree, Caesar.
I asked for a plan and an estimate. The plan I have now seen, what is the estimate?
10 years and 10 million gold pieces. Callistus says that he's going to...
Of course, Callistus. He's very careful with public money, and it's right that he should be. But economy can be carried too far. This is a matter of the utmost importance. Once Ostia is converted into a safe winter harbor, the danger of a corn famine will never rise again, at least as long as we hold Egypt and Africa. Besides, I should not be surprised to learn that it is the corn factors who have persuaded you that it would take so long and cost so much.
Caesar!
The scarcer the corn becomes, the richer they grow. They pray for bad weather and thrive on the miseries of the poor.
Caesar, can you believe that we would take bribes?
Persuaded, not bribed, was my word. Don't accuse yourself unnecessarily. Now listen to me. I am determined to carry this plan out, whatever the cost. So get that into your head.
Caesar!
And I'll tell you another thing. It is not going to take nearly as long or cost nearly as much as you seem to think.
You don't seem to understand that Rome cannot carry through public works on such a scale. All the grandest constructions in the world are the works of kings and queens. The walls and hanging gardens of Babylon, the mausoleum at Halicarnassus, the...
Come over here. Look out there. Do you see that? That's part of the greatest monument ever built. And though monarchs like Augustus and Tiberius have added to it and kept it in repair, it was first built by a free people. And I have no doubt that it will last as long as the pyramids, besides having proved of infinitely more service to mankind.
I cannot see at what you are pointing, Caesar.
I am pointing at the Appian Way, Callistus.
Oh.
The Roman road is the greatest monument ever raised to human liberty by a noble and generous people. It runs across mountain, marsh, and river. It is built broad and straight and firm. It joins city with city and nation with nation. It is tens of thousands of miles long. My harbor and the aqueducts that I plan to build will be worthy successors to the Roman road.
That's all very well, Caesar, but where can we find the money?
First of all, your estimate is incorrect.
Caesar, I'm a professional engineer.
And so were those who drew up a similar scheme for Julius Caesar 90 years ago. 10 years and 10 million gold pieces, you say? They said 4 years and 4 million gold pieces.
Things were cheaper then.
Yeah, I grant you there has been a slight increase in the price of materials and labor, but only a slight one.
Where did you get your figures from?
I am an historian, as well as an emperor. The palace archives are at my disposal. You need not bother to dispute my figures.
I cannot see where we will get even 4 million from.
We get it from those who are wealthy because Rome has no harbor, from the corn factors. My secretary Polybius will give you a list of the dozen most wealthy of them. Tell them they deserve to be thrown to the wild beasts, but they can prove their loyalty by an immediate loan of 1 million gold pieces. Enough to get things started.
And the repayment?
As soon as the financial situation justifies it. New aqueducts were my second major project. The existing water supply to Rome was by no means sufficient for the city's needs. In the summer, the poorest citizens were reduced to drinking and cooking in Tiber water, which was most unhealthy. The first aqueduct, afterwards called the Claudian Water, was to be 46 miles long, of which 10 were to run on arches. The second, called the New Anio, was to be nearly 59 miles long, and 15 miles or so were to run on arches. The work took nearly 9 years to complete, and when it was finished, it was among the chief wonders of Rome. There was so much to do. Messalina was an enormous help. Indeed, I could not have governed without her and gave her considerable powers. And nonetheless, I often worked a 14-hour day and soon began to show signs of fatigue. Before he left Rome, King Herod Agrippa had recommended to me a Greek doctor called Xenophon, who, he said, was a magician. I sent for him.
Now, let's see. You eat too much and drink too much. You must stop that. Make it a rule never to rise from the table without an unsatisfied longing for just one thing more. Yes, left leg much shrunk. No good prescribing exercise. Massage will have to do instead. You dribble on your pillow at night, of course?
Yes.
Fits of sudden anger?
Yes.
Fits of aphasia?
Yes.
Rigidity of muscles so that you often wake cold and stiff even on warm nights?
Yes.
You may bet again. Now, Caesar, I'm going to tell you about yourself. You have a good many years more to live, if you care to live them. How many hours a day do you work?
About 14.
Too many. Can't you do less?
Not at the moment. A lot of it is boring and monotonous, but there are certain things close to my heart that I wish to see done.
Well, I suppose I cannot prevent you from working, but I can advise you to reduce the strain, especially on your eyes. Make your secretaries read everything possible out to you. Do as little writing as you can. Rest for an hour after your principal meal. You must find time for 20 minutes massage twice a day. If you break my rules, you must not expect perfect health. Follow my directions, and you'll be a sound man. And now I leave you to your work.
Thank you, Xenophon. Look after your own health, won't you? You're the first doctor to treat me as a patient rather than an emperor. Thank you for that. Messalina told me that she thought I was extremely sensible to take such care of myself. Only 11 months after the birth of our son, our daughter Octavia was born, and it was shortly after this that Messalina came to me one evening with a troubled frown on her forehead. I was in a particularly happy mood.
Messalina, my dear, you know there are times when I almost enjoy being emperor.
And there are times when I think that your soft heart will be our downfall.
What does my pretty little songbird mean?
Your niece, Lesbia.
What about her?
She's back in Rome.
I know. I pardoned her. Caligula treated her very badly. The charges against her were never proved. I could not believe them of any daughter of my brother Germanicus.
Claudius, my dear simpleton, that woman's a snake. What is she trying to get out of you?
Nothing, so far as I know. She visits me occasionally to tell me yet again how grateful she is and to ask whether she can be of any use to me. She always asks after you.
Oh, I think I know her plan. She'll worm her way into your confidence and then begin slandering me.
Never.
Oh, not yet. She'll start with a few quiet hints, and then as she gets bolder, she'll become more direct. She'll probably make up some story about the double life I lead.
Huh?
She'll see that behind your back I live a life of debauchery.
Oh.
Sword fighters and actors and young gallants and the rest. And you'll believe her, of course, like a good uncle. Oh, God, what cats women are. I believe she's begun already, has she?
I told you, no, I wouldn't let her. I wouldn't believe anyone who told me you were unfaithful to me. I wouldn't believe it even if you told me so yourself.
Oh, forgive me, my dear, for being so jealous. It's my nature. I hate you to have friendships with other women, even relatives. I don't trust any woman alone with you. What did she say last time you saw her?
Well, I can't remember anything. Wait. Well, yes, she did recommend Seneca as a worthy man. She knows I can't abide him in spite of his reputation for oratory.
You're sure that she went out of her way to commend him? You didn't bring up his name first.
No, I never mention him if I can help it.
Then you may depend on it. Seneca's her lover. I know she has a secret lover, but she hides her tracks well. I'll keep my eyes open from now on.
Well, do, my dear, but I will be very surprised and very angry if your eyes see what you expect them to.
Claudius.
Hmm?
Do you love me, dearest husband?
More than anything else in the world.
Then will you show me the greatest kindness and understanding that your love for me is capable of showing?
Of course.
If it's not too hard for you, could you possibly allow me to sleep in a bedroom apart from you for a little while?
My dear.
It isn't that I don't love you every bit as much as you love me, but now that we've had two children in less than 2 years of marriage, oughtn't we to wait a bit before we risk having a third? It is a very disagreeable thing to be pregnant. I have morning sickness and heartburn, and my digestion goes wrong. And I don't feel I could go through that again just yet. I swear that I love you as much as ever, but having children uses up a lot of a woman's emotions, I suppose.
Yes.
I'm not hiding anything from you. You do believe me, don't you?
I believe you, and I love you. If you really feel like that, I'm not the sort of husband to insist on forcing anything on you, but is it really necessary for us to sleep apart? Couldn't we at least occupy the same bed for company's sake?
Oh, Claudius, it's been difficult enough for me to make up my mind to ask you about this because I love you so much and I don't want to hurt you. Don't make it more difficult. Can't you see how much better it would be for us to sleep apart for the moment?
How long do you think you'll want to be away?
We'll see how it works out.
How long?
I don't know. Does it matter so much? After all, sex is not essential to love as there are other strong bonds. I agree with Plato about that. He thought sex positively an obstruction to love.
He was talking of homosexual love.
Well, my dear, I do a man's work, and so it comes to much the same thing, doesn't it?
You're a great help to me.
In all other senses, I'm still your devoted little Messalina. And I'll continue to be suspicious of other women, even of your niece, Lesbia.
She moved out of our bedroom that very evening. I did not mention the subject again, hoping in time that she would come back to me. But she said nothing, only indicating by her tender behavior that a very fine understanding existed between us. Soon she told me that she had proof positive of adultery between Lesbia and Seneca, and of plots instigated by Lesbia against me. She brought witnesses. It was very painful for me to have to execute a daughter of my dear brother Germanicus, but I comforted myself with the thought that he would have acted as I had done if he had been in my place. He always put public duty before private feeling. Seneca, who was not involved in these plots, I banished to Corsica. These unpleasant but necessary actions brought my enemies into the open. The senator Vinicianus had a grievance against me, having been passed over for emperor. He realized that the only way to get rid of me was by force of arms, but where were the troops to be found to oppose me? I was still exceedingly popular with the guards. Vinicianus thought he knew the answer. Look abroad. There were 30,000 troops in Dalmatia, commanded by Scribonianus, a friend of his. Vinicianus wrote to Scribonianus. Fortunately, my intelligence intercepted and copied the letter. I hurriedly convened the Senate and addressed them.
My lords, you are aware of why you are here. Before having this letter read to you, I must tell you that I am most ready to agree to the demands contained in it, and should welcome the rest and security that it somewhat severely promises me. The only reason, indeed, that would induce me to decline the propositions made in it would be a strong feeling on your part that the country would be worse rather than better off if I did so. Here is the text. My secretary Polybius will read it to you.
I have bad news for you, my dear Scribonianus. Claudius, after disgracing the dignity of Rome by his stupidity, ignorance, and clowning, and by his complete dependence on the advice of a spendthrift rogue of a Jew, Herod Agrippa, and Messalina, his lustful and ambitious girl wife, has committed his first important crime. I do not refer to his execution of Lesbia, which may or may not be justified, but to the exiling of our revered Seneca. All right-minded men in the city agree that Seneca must be restored to his proper place among us, and consider that if a suitable leader appeared, the whole nation would welcome him with open arms. We look to you to come to our rescue. If you were to march on Rome with the 7th and 11th regiments, and whatever local forces you are able to muster, all our troubles would be over. As soon as you land in Italy, we shall join you with a volunteer force. Do not hesitate. Now is the time before matters get any worse. I have drawn up an ultimatum to Claudius saying that if he resigns as emperor, his life will be spared and that of his family.
Thank you, Polybius. My lord, the first thing that I did on reading this letter was to burst out laughing. Good heavens, what a delightful experience it would be to retire into private life again and live quietly and easily under an orderly government with my wife and my books and my children.
Never, Caesar!
You're needed, Caesar!
Did you see my difficulty? I admit that until last year I was shamefully ignorant of the arts of government and of legal and military procedure. And though I am learning daily, my education is still in arrears. But that is the fault of my original bad health and the poor opinion that my brilliant family had of my wits when I was a boy. It has not been due to any shirking of my duties. I take the liberty of suggesting that my family were mistaken, that I never was an imbecile. Augustus, Tiberius, and Caligula, my predecessors, were lions in their day. But now they are dead, and in the words of the Jewish proverb, a live dog is worth more than a dead lion. I am not a liar. You know that.
But I consider that I have not made so bad a watchdog. And to say that I have grossly mismanaged national affairs, or that I am an imbecile, is, I think, an insult to you rather than me, because you pressed the monarchy upon me. I have perhaps travelled further, hobbling on my lame leg, than most men would have travelled on a sound pair, because, only too conscious of my disability, I allowed myself no halts or slackening of pace. Vinicius, you wish to speak?
If you please, Caesar.
Proceed.
Caesar, my lords, as I see the case, this promised revolt is actuated by personal jealousy and personal ambition. We are asked, not merely to exchange an emperor who has proved himself in every way worthy of our admiration and obedience for one of whose capacities we know little and whose intentions we suspect, but to run the risk of a bloody civil war. Even if Scribonianus' attempt were to succeed, which I regard as most unlikely, what of Vinicianus? Would he be content to bow the knee to the haughty Scribonianus? Had he not, perhaps, offered his support on the understanding that the empire shall be shared between them? And if so, may we not expect another death duel to be fought, as once between Pompey and Julius Caesar, and again between Mark Antony and Augustus? No, my lords, this is a case where our loyalty, our gratitude, and our interest go hand in hand. We must loyally support Claudius Caesar until Vinicianus and Scribonianus have met the traitor's death they so richly deserve.
Thank you. I wish now to ask for a vote of confidence.
Hail Caesar!
Any dissident? Thank you, my lords. I will write today suspending Scribonianus from his command and order his return to Rome.
Hail Caesar! Hail Caesar!
Scribonianus never received my letter. He was already dead. He had made a great mistake in underrating the loyalty and intelligence of the army. A truly could easily be worked up into a state of temporary indignation on his behalf, and were not above accepting gifts in coin while in that mood, but a breach of their soldier's oath was not so easily bought. They would follow him to the ends of the earth, but not to Rome. When Scribonianus realized that all was lost, he committed suicide, as did Vinicianus a few days later. The revolt was over before it was properly launched. So I was still emperor, and my hopes of a safe and speedy return to private life were dashed. Since I had to be emperor, I might as well be a good one. My historical studies had convinced me that Britain must be converted into a frontier province. It was unsafe to allow an island so near to France and manned by so fierce and numerous a population to remain independent. There was nothing for it but to make war. My study of Julius Caesar's commentaries on his two British campaigns of 100 years before made it clear that considerable forces would have to be used. British noblemen fight from chariots like the Greek heroes of Troy. The chariot had, of course, disappeared from civilized warfare and remained only as an emblem of high military rank or of victory. British chariots are drawn by small, strong ponies, highly trained. They can be pulled up sharp even when traveling downhill at a good speed and turned right about in a flash. I had to evolve some new tactical plan for dealing with the British chariotry. Julius Caesar had been unable to hold them in check. After consultation with my army commanders, I withdrew 3 regiments from the Rhine, namely the 2nd, 20th, and 14th, and 1 from the Danube, the 9th. I entrusted the command of the expedition to Aulus Plautius, a distant connection of my first wife, Ergolenilla. The expeditionary force sailed on August the 1st, my 53rd birthday. I had told Plautius that should his losses amount to more than 1,000 killed, or should there appear to be any doubt as to the issue of the campaign, he was to send me a message and I would come to his help with my reserves. But the Forks met no resistance on landing. Caractacus, the British leader, had withdrawn his main army of 60,000 men to the tidal reaches of the Medway. It was here that the first battle took place, and although heavily outnumbered, Plautius's men drove a courageous army slowly backwards until they broke in undeniable rout. Caractacus reformed his men by the Thames. The second battle was a repetition of the first. The British defenses were weaker and their losses heavier. Ours were small, 300, and 2,000 prisoners taken. London was captured with rich booty. Plautius was now across the Thames, but the enemy resistance suddenly stiffened with the arrival of reinforcements. Plautius wisely sent for me. I set sail from Boulogne with my reinforcements, which included Indian elephants and camels. We marched to London, meeting no opposition, and I joined up with Plautius and his men. It appeared that Caractacus had been busy fortifying what would almost certainly be the site of the coming battle. This was a wooded range called Brentwood Hill, which curved around the London-Colchester Road in a great horseshoe, at each end of which was a stockaded fort with another in the center. If we marched against the central fort without first reducing the outer two, we would be heavily exposed on both our flanks. But to take the other two first was virtually impossible. It would mean fighting our way through thick woods on one side and a treacherous bog on the other. I convened a council of war with my commanders, Plautius, Vespasian, and Geta.
We are all agreed, Caesar, that a frontal attack is the only way.
I do not like the idea, Plautius.
Nor I, but there is no alternative.
I am not prepared to sacrifice one-tenth of the number of casualties that you estimate a frontal attack would cost.
You will not retain the respect of the army for long if you hesitate now. We are professional soldiers, Caesar.
And I have been studying tactics for 40 years, Rita. You can't teach me a thing. I know all the conventional moves and openings in the game of human drafts, but you must understand that I am not free to play the game in the way in which you would wish me to play it. Neither Drusus, my father, nor my brother Germanicus would ever have dreamed of making a frontal attack against a position as strong as this.
What would your noble relatives have done?
They'd have found a way round.
But there is no way round, Caesar. That has been established.
They'd have found a way round, I say.
Our scouts are positive that the wood is an impenetrable tangle of thorns. It would be impossible to get through at any point.
Geta is right, Caesar.
Plautus. Suppose I undertake to do the impossible and get our cavalry through the enemy's right flank, past this impenetrable tangle of thorns. Could you undertake to get the guards round on their left through the impossible bog?
Well, there is, as it happens, a track through the marshes. The troops would have to go along it in single file, but there is a track. I think I can undertake to get as many men across the marsh as care to follow me. But how can you hope to get your men through a thick wood?
We come now to my reason for bringing elephants with me. Firstly, they will terrify the Britons. No such animals have ever been seen on this island. Secondly, they are capable of bursting through the densest undergrowth imaginable. They are not daunted by briars or thorns. Now, do you see why we need not attack frontally?
It's unheard of, most irregular.
It could work.
It will work, gentlemen. I had prepared what I considered a very suitable speech with which to address the troops on the eve of battle. It began, "Romans, let no tongue among you wag, and no voice bellow vainly praising the days of old as days of true gold, and belittling the present age, of whose glories we should be the doughty champions, as a graceless age of gilded plaster." It went on at considerable length in the same lofty vein, but strangely enough, not one word of that speech was delivered. When I mounted the tribunal platform, I was greeted with such warmth by the captains and men that my speech went altogether out of my head, and I could only stretch out my hands to them, my eyes swimming with tears.
It's all right, lads. It's going to be all right. We have prepared a grand surprise for the Britons, and we're going to give them such a beating as they'll never forget as long as they live. I'm getting to be an old man now, but this is the proudest moment of my life. I only wish my brother Germanicus were here to share it with me. Do any of you remember my great brother? Aye. Not many, perhaps, for he died 24 years ago, but you all have heard of him as the greatest general that Rome ever had. Aye. The battle cry tomorrow will be Germanicus! The 20th Regiment will lead the assault. Germanica has always said that in barracks, you 20s were the most insubordinate, most drunken, and most quarrelsome troops in the entire regular army. But you were absolute lions in the field. The 2nd and 14th, Germanica has called you the backbone of the army. Tomorrow, you will act as the army's ribs. Hooray! Now, the 9th. The 9th will come up last, because Germanicus always used to say that the 9th were the slowest regiment in the army, but also the surest. That's all I have to say. Be good, lads. Sleep well. And earn your father's gratitude tomorrow.
They cheered me until they were hoarse. Covered by the darkness of night, the first company marched silently out of the eastern gate of the camp. They were told to break steps so that their measured tread should not be heard by the enemy's outposts, and their weapons were muffled with rags so that they should not knock together. They travelled over 3 or 4 miles of rough, boggy country until they reached the marsh proper. They found the track and kept to it. Shortly, the British outpost, stationed at the far end, saw a sight and heard a sound that filled them with the utmost dismay. A great bird with a long, shining bill, a huge grey body and legs 15 feet long, suddenly rose up through the mist, a javelin throw away, and began stalking up and down, stopping every now and then to boom hoarsely and flap its wings.
It's the Heron King!
The bird jerked its head angrily and with outspread wings turned towards them. The men ran for their lives. The Heron King slowly promenaded along the edge of the marsh. In case you think it was the Heron King who had come to frighten them off, I must explain the rules. The bird was, in fact, a French soldier from the great marshes to the west of Marseille, where the shepherds are accustomed to walk on long stilts as a means of striding across soft patches of ground. The man had been rigged up in a wickerwork basket construction in the shape of a bird's body, stretched over with blanket stuff. Wicker wings, covered with cloth, were attached to his arms. The beak was treated with phosphorus. The boom was made by an ingenious water pipe in his mouth. Once the Britons had fled, our troops moved forwards. 8,000 men crossed the marshes in single file during the night. It was still dark when I gave the order for the main body to move into position. forward to greet each regiment as it arrived. There was a thick mist all around us. And now I want to describe to you the battle as seen by the Briton, because that way you will be better able to appreciate my plan of attack. Just before dawn, the sally port of the central fort opens, and out drives a division of the Briton's chariotry. Another division drives out of the fort on the wooded western side, led by Caractacus himself. At last, the tramp and clank of approaching regiments can be heard. The leading company of the 20th appears dimly through the mist. The Britons roar defiance. Suddenly, the Romans halt. And a curious sight is seen. A company of immensely tall, long-necked beasts with humps on their backs are being trotted up and down, in and out of the mist. The Britons are alarmed at the sight and mutter charms against magic. They are uncertain whether to attack the 20th, for only 500 men have appeared. Caractacus signals the advance. Then a strange thing happens. As soon as the column of chariots sweeps down into the mist where the beasts have been seen, the ponies go quite mad. They squeal, buck, snort, balk, and cannot be forced to go a step further. It is clearly a magic mist. If there is one thing that horses hate, it is the smell of camel. I have been careful to keep our cavalry well away from them. With the Britons in confusion, the 20th charge out of the mist. Shower after shower of javelins fly from their hands. Caractacus launches his own attack and sweeps down on the halted Roman man, who appears to have left their flank unprotected. But a more powerful charm than a stinking mist protects this flank. To the sound of six claps of thunder and six simultaneous flashes of lightning, great balls of burning pitch hurtle through the air. The terrified column swings away. Caractacus now decides to attack the Romans' rear, but as he charges forward, catastrophe follows. Chariot after chariot comes crashing to the ground. They are so closely bunched together, and the impetus of their downhill rush is so great that nobody can pull up or turn without colliding with his neighbor. Suddenly, up springs a horde of tall, naked black men brandishing white spears. They fling themselves at the wreckage, and their long spears dart here and there among the fallen men. Caractacus manages to escape from the slaughter and trips as he does so over tightly stretched tent rope, pegged knee-high in the long grass. Two battalions advance to assist the Nubian native. Caractacus returns to the central fort to find the garrison has fled. He hears the sound of Roman trumpets and sees eight battalions of Roman regulars advancing on his right. Away on his left, he sees elephants emerging from the wood, followed by Roman cavalry. They charge towards him. The sight of the elephants sends the Britons scurrying in all directions. Caractacus, realizing the battle is lost, blows two blasts on his ivory horn to signal a general retreat. We took 8,000 prisoners and counted 4,700 corpses. Our losses were insignificant. We piled a great trophy on the battlefield of broken chariots and weapons and burnt it as a thank offering to Mars. Caractacus was overtaken at Chelmsford, but managed to escape. I formally declared his empire a Roman province under the governorship of Plautius, and presently received homage from all its petty kings and chiefs. After this, I decided that I had done all that I had come to Britain to do. I said farewell to Plautius and his army, and returned to Rome. I had been a mere 16 days in Britain. The Senate voted me a triumph, the highest honor known to a Roman, and gave me the hereditary title of Britannicus, the name by which my son Drusus came to be known. The triumph lasted 3 days. It is probable that it will never happen again to anyone in this world, and it is certain that it has never happened to anyone before, to fight his first battle at the age of 53, never having performed military service of any sort in his youth, win a crushing victory, and never take to the field again for the rest of his life. There is a postscript to my campaign in Britain. A few years after my triumphal return, Caractacus, having continued to do noble battle with us in Wales, was eventually captured and brought to Rome in chains. He came before Plautius and myself, his head held high, looking neither to the left nor the right. Then he made a dignified obeisance.
Caesar! I ask your permission to speak.
Granted.
You see me here in chains before you, suing for my life. For my prolonged resistance to you, I have no apologies to offer. I had men-at-arms, chariots, horses, and treasure. You wonder that I was unwilling to part with them. You Romans aim at extending your sway over all mankind. It does not follow that all mankind will immediately accept that sway. You must first prove your right to rule, and prove it with the sword. It has been a long war between us, Caesar. Your armies have pursued me from tribe to tribe and from fort to fort, and I have taken heavy toll of them. Now I am caught, and the victory is yours at last. If I had surrendered to your Lieutenant Plautius at our first engagement, I should have proved an unworthy foe, and he would never have sent for you. You would never have visited our island, never celebrated your deserved triumph. Therefore, respect your enemy now that he is humbled. Grant him his life, and your noble clemency will never be forgotten, either by your own country or mine. Britain will reverence the clemency of the victor if Rome approves the courage of the conquered.
Plautius, let me have your opinion. For my part, I am willing to let this brave king go free.
Free, Caesar?
No, no, not entirely. To restore him to his throne in Britain would be regarded as weakness. I cannot do that. But I am inclined to let him stay here in Rome as a guest of the city with a pension suited to his needs and also to release his family and household. What do you say?
He has shown himself a gallant foe. If you release him, I shall be proud to take him by the hand and offer him friendship.
Very well. Remove the prisoner's chains.
Caesar, I thank you.
You have spoken bravely and well, Caractacus. We shall dine together tonight, you and I, and fight again the Battle of Brentwood Hill as the wine goes round.
Caesar, I wish for every Roman citizen a heart like yours.
Aww. And so I returned to civil dress and my duties in Rome. I continued my reforms, doing all I could to create a sense of responsibility in my subordinates. The harbor at Ostia was not finished and had already cost 6 million gold pieces. It finally took 10 years to complete and cost 12 million gold pieces, and there are still men working on it even today. Everything seemed to be going well for me and for Rome. The country was contented and prosperous, and our armies were victorious everywhere. My health was good. Messalina was lovelier in my eyes than ever. My children were growing up strong and healthy. Once again, I looked forward to my old dream of resigning the monarchy. And I told myself, Augustus always said that he would resign and restore the Republic, but somehow he never did, because of Livia. And Tiberius always said the same, but somehow he never did. I really am going to resign. There's nothing to prevent me. My conscience is clear, and Messalina is no Livia. So I reasoned, and so I had determined, when early one morning Messalina came into my bedroom.
Claudius! Oh, Claudius, my darling, wake up.
What?
Claudius, I have terrible news.
What is it?
You know my astrologer, Barbalus.
Oh, yes.
You know he never makes a mistake.
Well, that is his reputation.
Well, yesterday I asked him to read the stars for me because he had not done so for 2 or 3 years. Yes. He observed them last night. Do you know what he's just come and told me?
Well, of course I don't know. Out with it. Let me go back to sleep.
Oh, darling, I wouldn't dare to disturb you like this if it wasn't so important. What he said was, Lady Messalina, a frightful fate is in store for one very near to you. This is Saturn's baleful influence. Indeed, the blow will fall within 30 days, not later than the Ides of September. Yeah. I asked him what he meant, but he wouldn't tell me. At last, I dragged it out of him by threatening to have him flogged.
Yes, well, go on.
He said, Lady Messalina, your husband will die a violent death.
What?
Now you see, my darling, why I found it hard to tell you.
Is there nothing to be done? Can't we cheat the prophecy somehow?
I can't think of anything. You're my husband, aren't you? Unless... Listen, yeah. I have an idea. Suppose that just for this next month you aren't my husband.
Well, but I am. We can't change that.
You could divorce me, couldn't you, just for a month? And marry me again when Barbalus reports that Saturn has moved to a safe distance?
No, that's not possible. If I divorce you, we can't legally remarry unless there's been a marriage in between.
Well, I didn't think of that. But don't let's be beaten by a mere technicality. Suppose then that I do marry someone.
What?
Well, just as a matter of form. Anyone, a cook or a porter or one of the palace guards. Oh. Only the ceremonial part of the marriage, of course. We'd go into the nuptial chamber by one door and come right out again by another. That would do, wouldn't it?
Possibly, but you need to marry someone of importance or it would create a bad impression. Well, let me think. How about my understudy, Vitellius?
But, darling, what about the prophecy? Vitellius is a friend of yours. You wouldn't want him to come to a violent end, would you?
No, I wouldn't.
Haven't you got any enemies?
Too many.
Who's been particularly troublesome recently? What about Silius?
Silius? Oh, he's certainly been troublesome. He led the opposition in the Senate to a bill of mine recently, one that I particularly set my heart on.
Also, I can tell from the way he looks at me.
What?
Oh, he's very polite and reserved in my presence, but underneath he is boiling with passion for me. Really, I can tell. What a punishment if I tell him that I'm being divorced and want to marry him, and at the last moment he finds out that it is a marriage in form only.
So we chose Silius. And that very day I signed the document repudiating Messalina as my wife. Everyone in Rome was astounded at the news, particularly as it seemed to make no difference to us. I continued to show her as much respect as before, or even more, and she continued her political work at the palace. But every day she visited Silius at his house quite openly, with a full retinue of attendants. When I suggested that she was carrying the joke rather too far, she told me that she was finding some difficulty in getting him to consent to the marriage. After a few days of this, she gleefully reported that he had consented and would marry her on the 10th of September. She asked me to officiate as high pontiff and see the fun. One morning, A few days before this ceremony was due to take place, I went to Ostia to dedicate a big granary there. Messalina pleaded one of her sick headaches and stayed behind in Rome. Early that afternoon, my secretary brought me a letter which had been handed to him in the street. To my surprise, it was written in Etruscan, an extinct language known to not more than 4 or 5 living people. It read, "Great danger in Rome. Come to my house at once. Don't waste a moment." It startled and puzzled me. Why Etruscan? Whose house? What danger? It was a moment or two before I understood. It must be from Calpurnia, the girl who had lived with me before I married Messalina, do you remember? It had amused me to teach her Etruscan while I was compiling my history of Etruria. I had bought her a villa in Ostia when I married Messalina. I hurried to it at once.
Oh, Claudius.
Calpurnia, what's the matter? Why have you sent for me? Are you in danger?
You are, Claudius, you are.
Please stop crying and tell me, what is it?
You'll not want to believe me. You'll want to have me tortured and flogged.
Tell me at once.
I don't want to tell you, but nobody else dares, so I must. I promised Narcissus and Xenophon that I would. They said you would not believe them or anyone, but I said I thought you'd believe me. I was never greedy or jealous or dishonest, was I? I was always a true friend.
Cousin Pernia, in my life I have known only 3 good women. One was Cypros, a Jewish princess. One was Briseis, my mother's wardrobe maid. And the 3rd is you. Now, tell me what you have to say.
You've left out Messalina.
Messalina goes without saying. Very well, then, 4 really good women. And I don't consider that I'm insulting Messalina by linking her with an Oriental princess, a Greek freedwoman, and a prostitute from Padua.
If you put Messalina on the list, leave me out.
You needn't be modest, Calpurnia. I mean what I say.
You're not being modest.
Then I don't understand.
I hate to hurt you, Claudius. But I mean this. If Cypros had been a typical princess of the Herod family, if she had been bloodthirsty and ambitious and unscrupulous and without any moral restraint, and if Briseis had been a typical wardrobe maid, if she had been thieving and base-minded and lazy and clever at covering up her tracks, and if I had been a typical prostitute, vain, lustful, promiscuous and greedy, and used my beauty as a means for dominating and ruining men, and if you were now listing the 3 worst types of women you know and happened to pick on us as convenient examples, then, Claudius, you would be right to add Messalina to that list.
Am I mad or are you?
Not I.
Then what do you mean? What has my poor Messalina done to be suddenly attacked in a violent and extraordinary way? I don't think that you and I are going to remain friends much longer, Calpurnia.
You left Rome at 7 o'clock this morning.
Yes.
I left at 10. I looked in at the wedding. Curious time of day for a wedding, wasn't it? They were having a grand time. Everyone drunk, marvellous show.
What wedding? Talk sense, girl.
Messalina's wedding to Silius. Weren't you invited? She was there dancing. Dressed in a short white tunic with one breast exposed and her hair flying loose. She was almost decent, though, compared with the other women, because they were Bacchantes. Silius was Bacchus.
But the wedding isn't until the 10th. I'm to officiate.
They're managing very nicely without you. So I went to your secretary, Narcissus, at the palace, and when he saw me, he said, "Thank God you're here, Calpurnia. You're the only one who'll believe, and Xenophon."
Well, I don't believe it. I refuse to believe it.
They're waiting outside. Narcissus! Xenophon!
Caesar.
Is it true about the wedding?
Yes, Caesar.
I know all about it. It's not a real wedding, my friends. It's a sort of joke that Messalina and I planned. She's not going to bed with him at the end of the ceremony. It's all quite innocent.
I saw Silius catch at Messalina and pull up her tunic and began kissing her body in full view of the company, and she screamed and laughed. Then he carried her off to the nuptial chamber. They stayed there nearly an hour before coming out again to do some more dancing and drinking.
That's not innocent, Caesar, surely.
Unless you act at once, Caesar, Sir Laius will be master of Rome. Messalina and Sir Laius have sworn to restore the Republic. They claim that they have the whole Senate behind them.
I must hear more. I don't know whether to laugh or to cry. I don't know whether to pour gold in your lap or flog you until the bones show.
I will tell you, Caesar, but I find it hard to believe you do not know what all Rome, all the provinces for that matter, even our enemies over the frontier knew. It has been 9 years, Caesar. It seems impossible you should not have heard of her debaucheries.
Tell me!
I'll give you one example, Claudius, and then no more. While you were in Britain, Messalina issued a challenge to the Prostitutes Guild, asking them to provide a champion to contend with her at the palace, to see which of the two would wear out most men in the course of a night. The guild sent a Sicilian named Scylla. I know her well and can vouch for her prowess, but when dawn came, she had to confess herself beaten at the 25th.
And Michelina?
She continued out of bravado until the sun was quite high in the sky.
How did you know this?
We were forced to attend, as were the nobility of Rome. Many of the men took part in the orgy, and three or four of the women were persuaded by Messalina to compete too. Who's Xenophon, quick?
He's fainted, that's all. I'll soon have him all right.
I don't believe anyone will ever have him all right again.
I call this my Olympian draught. There. Soon he'll come round. His wits will wander momentarily, then he'll become clear-headed and self-possessed, even euphoric.
You know, at the first games that I ever attended, I saw a sword fighter have his shield arm lopped off at the shoulder. He was quite close to me. I saw his face clearly. Such a stupid look when he saw what had happened, and the whole amphitheatre roared with laughter at him. I thought it funny, too. God forgive me.
It's working.
Bernia. Narcissus. Is it true?
Every word, Caesar.
Xenophon, is it true?
I am only your doctor, Caesar.
Claudius, my dear, it won't help asking the same question over and over again. It's quite plain. They were all afraid to tell you until now. Partly because they know how much you loved and trusted Messalina, but mostly because you're emperor.
Yes. I see it all now.
Claudius, if you don't act at once, you will be sentencing us all to death. Send messengers to Rome to say that you're on your way to take vengeance on Silas and your wife. Send warrants for the arrest of everyone at the wedding. That will probably be enough to smother the revolt. They'll all be too drunk to do anything dangerous, but hurry!
Yes, I'll hurry. Narcissus, get the guards to Rome and arrest the whole wedding party. No violence, though, except in self-defense.
Was ever anyone so deceived? When the whole party had been arrested and the examinations were complete, a list of Messalina's lovers was drawn up. It contained 156 names. As you may have guessed, the most painful consideration of all was that my little Britannicus and Octavia were perhaps not my children. During the dreadful days that followed, such thoughts tormented me and made me depend more and more on the administrations of Xenophon and his Olympian draft. Therefore, I was not displeased when rumors began to circulate that I was being worshipped as a god in distant Britain. The children of the gods are always legitimate.
And how do you feel today, Caesar?
I don't know what you keep giving me, Xenophon, but I feel as if I am treading on clouds, like a god. Oh, yes. Now, tell me, Narcissus, what is all this about me being worshipped as a god in Britain? Is it a joke?
Oh, it's not altogether a joke, Caesar. A temple at Colchester has been dedicated to the god Claudius Augustus. They have been worshipping there since the early summer.
No wonder I feel so strange. It's not Xenophon's Olympian draft at all. I've been turning into a god. But how did it happen? I remember sanctioning the erection and dedication of a temple to the god Augustus, my granduncle.
I suppose, Caesar, they made the natural mistake of understanding Augustus as meaning yourself. His name means nothing to the Britons in comparison to your own. The natives speak you there, I'm told, with the deepest religious awe.
So, I'm a god now, am I? Herod Agrippa always said that I'd end as a god. I told him he was talking nonsense. Oh, the way your mixture makes me feel, Xenophon, I don't care. I don't care about anything. Suppose I have that miserable woman, Messalina, brought in here for trial at once.
She's dead, Caesar?
Dead.
At your own orders?
I don't remember giving any orders. Still, it's all the same now. I wonder what sort of a god I am. One of my tutors used to explain to me the Stoic idea of God. God was a perfectly rounded whole, immune from accident or event. I always pictured him as an enormous pumpkin. You know, I eat much more goose or drink much more wine, I'll become pumpkinified too. So Messalina's dead. Well. She was a beautiful woman, my friend, but bad.
Beautiful, but bad, Caesar.
Carry me to bed, someone, and let me sleep the blessed sleep of the gods. I'm a blessed god now, aren't I? Well.
So they took me to bed. I stayed there until noon the next day. The Senate met in my absence and passed a motion congratulating me on the suppression of the revolt and another expunging Messalina's name from the archives and from every public inscription and destroying all her statues. I rose in the afternoon and resumed my imperial work. I began to talk grandly of the conquest of Germany, and Narcissus, realizing that Xenophon's medicine was having too violent an effect, disordering my wits instead of merely tiding me gently over the shocks I had received, told him to give me no more of it. Gradually, my Olympian mood faded, and I felt pathetically mortal again. I called for my sedan and ordered that I be taken to the gardens of Lucullus. There, seated on a garden bench beneath a cedar, I began solemnly to work out just where and how I stood.
Despite my strong republican feelings, I became emperor. If I had refused, I would have been killed. It was an emergency measure only. And yet, I have found it impossible to resign my powers. I have become a second Augustus. I'm not a conscious hypocrite. I flatter myself I was acting for the best. If I carried out my honest intent and restored the Republic, what then? The world is perfectly content with me as emperor. Nobody really wants the Republic back. I have decided. I will not, after all, carry out my plan to resign. The frog pool wanted a king. Jove sent them old King Log. Like a log, I have been deaf and blind. And wooden. My chief fault. I repaired the ruin my predecessors spread. I reconciled Rome and the world to monarchy again. Rome is fated to bow to yet another Caesar. Let him be mad, bloody, capricious, wasteful, lustful. Yet I am, I must remember, old King Log. I shall float inertly in the stagnant pool. Let all the poisons that lurk in the mud hatch out. I kept my resolution. I have kept it strictly ever since. 3 months after Messalina's death, I decided to take a fourth wife. Narcissus, Callistus, and Pallas came forward with suitable candidates, but I ignored them all. I chose my niece, Agrippinilla, known as Agrippina. The announcement was greeted with shock. In the first place, the marriage would be incestuous. In the second place, she was the mother of Lucius Domitius, to whom I'd taken a most violent dislike. In the third place, now that Messalina was dead, she could claim the title of the worst woman in Rome. Even in Messalina's lifetime, it would have been a very nice question to decide between these two. They were equally vicious, and if Messalina had been more promiscuous than Agrippina, she had at least never committed incest, as Agrippina had, to my knowledge. But Agrippina had one lonely virtue. She was brave, while Messalina was a coward. Agrippina took after her great-grandmother, the goddess Livia. She cared only for power. Sexually, she may have been completely immoral, yet she only slept with men who could be useful to her politically. When I summoned her to tell her of my choice, she fell on her knees at my feet.
Caesar, this is the happiest moment of my life.
I believe you. You want power, Agrippina. You will have it. Through me, you will be able to rule the world.
I do not understand.
Let me explain. I have become tired of being emperor. I want someone to do the work for me. I marry you not for your heart, but for your head. It takes a woman to rule an empire like this. There is no reason for us to pretend amorous devotion to each other.
Well, that suits me. You're not exactly the sort of lover one dreams about.
And you were not what you were 22 years ago, my dear, when you were a bride for the first time. Still, you last a little longer if you continue with your daily facial massages and your milk bath.
And perhaps you'll last too if you don't exasperate the people you depend on.
We too have outlasted all the rest of our family. I don't know how we have done it, but I think we ought to congratulate each other instead of quarreling.
I agree.
You will not find it necessary to coax or cheat or bully me if you want things done your way, Agrippina. I will accept your suggestions on almost every point.
Then I have a favor.
Granted.
Adopt my son, Lucius, as your...
Granted.
I would like to change his name.
Call him whatever you like.
I would like to call him Nero.
I am nearing the end of my long story. I have now been married to Agrippina for nearly 5 years, and they have been comparatively uneventful. I have continued to play old King Log, and let my wife and my secretary rule me. I have opened and shut my mouth and gestured with my arms, but the voice has not been mine, nor the gestures. I must say at once that Agrippina has shown herself a remarkably able ruler of the tyrannical sort. Nero is afraid of her. He obeys her in everything. She treats him with great severity. She is certain that she will rule through him after my death, just as Livia ruled first through Augustus and then through Tiberius. Let me explain. why I deliberately chose Nero in preference to my own son, Britannicus. I remembered that the Sibyl had prophesied to me that Nero would kill his mother, that he is fated to rule as my successor, carrying on the cursed business of monarchy fated to plague Rome and earn everlasting hatred, to be the last of the mad Caesars. Yes, we are all mad, we emperors. We begin sanely like Augustus and Tiberius and even Caligula, though he was an evil character, he was sane at first. And monarchy turns our wits. After Nero's death, surely the Republic will be restored, and it is my intention that Britannicus should be the one to restore it. But how is Britannicus to live through the reign of Nero? Nero will surely put him to death if he remains in Rome. There is only one place for him, and that is Britain, where I am a god. On Nero's death, he will reveal himself and return as the savior of his country. When I married Agrippina, I knew that I could count on surviving as long as Nero was too young to step into my shoes. He is now 17. Barbilus has lately read my horoscope and fears I am destined to die on the 13th of September in the 14th year of my reign. Today, Barbilus is always right. Well, I am prepared to die. My eyes are weary, and my hands shake. I remember what the great historian Pollio said to me many years ago. Just before you die, there comes a strange lucidity. One speaks prophetically. He was right. I know I will be poisoned tonight. Britannicus will never go to Britain. The Republic will never be restored. All my ingenuity has been wasted, all my labor in vain, all the industrious work that I carried out in my early years of monarchy as a gift to an undeserving Senate and people. Yes. We are all mad. We emperors. Say no more now. Tiberius Claudius, God of the Britons, say no more.
Timothy West played Claudius in Claudius the God by Robert Graves, with Mel Martin as Messalina, Francis Jeter as Calpurnia, Harold Casket as Herod, Henry Stamper as Caractacus, Brett Usher as Xenophon, and Nerissa Knights as Agrippina. Callistus was played by Colin Starkey, Pallas, Jamie Roberts, Engineer Robin Summers, Polybius Alan Thompson, Vinicius Graham Blocky, Plautius Ronald Herdman, and Narcissus Brian Smith. The radio version of Claudius the God was by Eric Ewens, adapted and directed by Glyn Dearman.